Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm very pleased that we can begin today's morning show with the Honorable Corey Mason, the mayor of the city of Racine. There are a number of important issues that we want to speak with the mayor about, and his time is limited, of course, and so we appreciate him making time for the morning show in his schedule. Mayor Mason, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, we are recording this actually on Tuesday, the day after a very important Racine City Council meeting, which folds very directly into the pressing issue of COVID-19. Maybe ahead of talking about what happened at Monday night City Council meeting, set the stage in terms of what had happened that necessitated the conversation and move that eventually happened in the meeting.
Yeah, great question. So, I mean, everybody is obviously still concerned about where we are with COVID. The Racine community is still the leader in the state, unfortunately, is the most cases per capita. And so we remain concerned about our infection rate and the community spread around coronavirus and the impact that it has to our residents. We've got 23 deaths as a result of it at this point. And so what we've been relying on, as has Milwaukee and Dane County and Brown and other areas, have been relying on the authority that their public health administrators have to put restrictions in place that, you know, require social distancing, 6 feet apart, you know, the partial reopenings of some of our businesses so they're not at full capacity, so you don't have people shoulder to shoulder in close proximity, you know, and potentially spreading coronavirus any further. And so last Friday, there was the unusual step that a local judge took where he said he didn't believe that the statutes under Wisconsin law give the local health administrator the authority to make such orders, which took us a bit by surprise, but necessitated the need for the council to come in and pass an ordinance of its own then to clearly give the health administrator the authority that she would need to make sure that we were safe and able to take reasonable actions in the midst of the pandemic to try to mitigate its spread and minimize as much as possible the risk to public health.
So tell us about then the conversation that took place at Monday night's city council meeting and the steps that you felt and the council ultimately decided needed to be taken in light of that.
Yeah, so I mean, again, you know, we have this unusual case where we're only in Racine at this moment. You have one judge saying that the statutes don't give our health authority, our health department, the authority they need to do public health, which is a bit odd. But again, so the city, as you know, a chartered city in the state of Wisconsin with its own constitutional authority for local control, can certainly confer that. And so we amended our communicable disease ordinances to make it clear that we could continue with the recommendations that we've been taking. So the Forward Racine plan has become the Safer Racine plan under the ordinance. And so there's really nothing different from Friday until today. I mean, we're still looking at reopening policies. We can still have the sidewalk cafes, bars and restaurants can still be at 50% capacity as long as they're maintaining 6 feet of social distancing. Our retailers can still fully be opened. So, you know, we're doing the work of evaluating where we are with COVID on a you know, almost weekly basis in terms of where we are. And on June 30th, there'll be an announcement, we hope, that allows us to loosen up the restrictions a little bit more, but we need to be measured about it as we consider what the spread of coronavirus is here in the community. So the good news in the community is our infection rate has gone down. We were as high as 41% of those getting tested to now as low as, you know, 10-12% of those getting tested are infected. But we still have more cases per capita than any other community in the state of Wisconsin. And we've had 23 deaths and over 100 people hospitalized. And so we continue to be concerned about the virus's impact. And, you know, there's also been a large number of public gatherings of people protesting the murder of George Floyd, which, you know, while I sympathize with the cause of that from a social distancing public health standpoint, you know, we're concerned about what that might mean in terms of additional cases moving forward. So we still have work to do. I think the hardest part of it, and with the debate that we heard last night, is people are just exhausted by all this. I mean, coronavirus has been really devastating to, I think, all of us culturally, from a health standpoint, for those who get sick, economically, for those who are trying to remain employed or keep their small business open. It has been really hard for all of us. And so it seems counterintuitive then to just open things back up quickly, because we think that's going to lead to more infections and make the duration of the pandemic take that much longer if we don't take the precautions that we should to try to keep as many people safe as we possibly can.
Right. In other words, people want this to be over, but you can't just wish it to be over.
Yeah, Alderman Meekma had sort of an interesting comment last night. He said, look, just because you're over it doesn't mean the pandemic's over. And I really had a lot of sympathy for what he was saying there. I mean, everybody wants this to be done, right? I mean, we've got three kids at home. We've been trying to figure out how to do that for weeks now. I mean, we're now going into the fourth month of all this. I don't think anybody has a frame of reference for how to deal with a public health crisis that lasts this long. But we continue to see disparities in our community of, you know, 82% of the cases are African-American and Latino residents, and they make up about 45% of the population, so almost double the infection rate amongst people of color. And so, I mean, we continue to be concerned about what we're seeing here, and we have a responsibility to keep everybody safe, even as we know it's a real imposition for people economically or for their ability to move around the way they're used to moving around. It is an extraordinary time, and it requires extraordinary measures, which is why we had the special meeting on Monday night and the council took the action that it did.
When you receive the latest numbers in terms of new cases of COVID-19 in the city of Racine and or Racine County, at what point are you also informed about, for instance, what communities are being impacted? I mean, for instance, the number of African Americans who are part of those numbers, or particular places where COVID-19 seems to be breaking out. Is that information also available to you, in a sense, immediately, or does it take time for those kind of specifics to be given to you?
Yeah, the demographics that we get, and we release them on Monday and Friday of every week. And so if people go to the City of Racine Facebook page or RacineCoronavirus.org, you will see breakdowns of the number of cases that we're seeing as they're graphed out over time. But then it also breaks down by ethnicity and race, as well as gender and age, in terms of who it is that's contracting coronavirus here in the City of Racine. In terms of specifically where they are, that gets into some privacy rules around Health Insurance Privacy Protection Act. So I can't tell you specifically where it is. I mean, we can look at it by census tracts and whatnot, but there's been no, you know, one sort of like, we can't sort of say, you know, 80% of the cases in the city we're seeing are just in one aldermanic ward, for example. So they're pretty spread out.
And, right.
You know.
And I'm just curious, is it that you can't share that, or is it that you don't know that, or is it a little bit of both?
I suppose we could try to recreate it. I think what happens, though, is it gives people a false sense that, well, as long as it's over there and not by me, then I'm immune to it. And, you know, I mean, that would maybe work a little bit better if everybody were actually sheltering in place and nobody was moving around, but people still go to the grocery store, people still go out and interact with people, there's still mobility around. And so while that's happening, it's not going to give people the security that they might think that it would to know where the people reside. I mean, we certainly know that they're city residents based on the information that we have, but there are privacy rules that we have to be concerned about. Now, certainly if there's a breakout in a certain business or a certain, a certain public space repeatedly, we move in to try to address those specific hotspots. But the city itself, writ large, remains a hotspot here in southeast Wisconsin. We are in between Milwaukee and just south of the border in Illinois is one of the fastest growing coronavirus cases in the country in terms of outbreaks. And so, Lake County has been hit hard too. And so we are right in between those two areas, which is why I think you're continuing to see southeast Wisconsin look at this a little bit differently than other parts of the state might.
Right, and that makes sense. So remind our listeners of the kind of restrictions that now then are in place, and also clarify to what extent these are strongly worded suggestions that are voluntary versus ordinances that, in a sense, carry the weight of law. I mean, that these are requirements.
Yes, that's a great question. So we did pass an ordinance last night reinforcing the safer Racine policies that were prior call for Racine. And they are enforceable by law. There's up to a $250 municipal fine for people violating them. And what it basically says is that if you're out in public, you have to maintain social distancing, that that you can only be in crowds of a certain size based on the size of the facility that you're in, that bars and restaurants are limited to 50% capacity. And that even if you have full capacity, you're still required to keep your customers and your employees 6 feet apart. So that is the law. Now, we are not running around trying to write tickets as quickly as we possibly can. We're trying to mitigate a public health crisis. And so we always try to educate people first if they're not in compliance with the ordinance, because we're not looking to penalize people. We're looking to keep people safe from a public health standpoint. And so, what we find is that's really important. The other thing that I would say to people is everything that we've been saying about the safer Racine, people should check out the RacineCoronavirus.org and the StaySafeRacine.org websites on best practices and best policies. But, if you're going to go out in public, it is really important to wear a mask. And it's really important to stay 6 feet apart from everyone and to wash your hands frequently. These are as true today as they were a month ago when people were paying a little bit more attention to these issues. The harder part, I think, is that everybody's just tired, right? And so all the more reason we need people to still engage in best practices and be careful. And I know the weather is getting nicer outside, and so people want to be outside and engage with one another, which makes sense. But particularly if you go indoors, just be mindful that we are still in the midst of a pandemic that is highly contagious and can get people ill and even lead to death. And so as people are going out to plan activities or to interact with friends and family or business associates, we just really ask people to use caution and ask if it's really necessary that they move forward that, or if they can do it remotely or communicate without being physically in the same place. And I know that is harder and harder to do as more time marches on. But we have more cases today than we've ever had before, and we remain concerned about the 1,437 people as of this morning who are city residents who've contracted coronavirus.
I don't remember if it was with you or with the mayor Antaramian that I learned that a number of different mayors are communicating on a very regular basis during COVID-19. I think it was Mayor Antaramian who actually told me about that. I wonder if you could just give us a little bit of insight on the kind of conversations that occur between you and the kind of maybe best practices that are shared, or is it just a commiseration sessions? I mean, what is kind of the nature of those conversations, and to what extent have they been helpful in any kind of substantial or specific way?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically comparing notes with your colleagues, right? So it's the, we get together regularly, not in person, obviously, but over the phone or Zoom with other mayors and have conversations about how we're all dealing with the crisis management that comes along with a pandemic, and then, you know, the protests that have come along and everything along with it. And so it's helpful to compare notes with colleagues to see, you know, what strategies and tactics they might be using to try to mitigate coronavirus, for example, or how we dealt with the spring elections or any other number of things. And so it's just really helpful to compare notes and see what other people are doing or what challenges they're facing, and learning how other communities have perhaps come up with an idea that you didn't think of or overcame a challenge that you might be wrestling with in a way that had not yet occurred to you, or just, you know, sharing best practices has been very helpful. It's helpful generally, but it's been particularly helpful in 2020 as we've been going through so much as a state and as our respective communities.
A last question about COVID. This is still in the, I mean, it seems like it's gone on forever, but in the grand scheme of things, of course, this just began yesterday, really. I mean, that is, this is all still very, very new, even though, of course, the whole matter of distancing feels really old by now. All of this is really very, very new, and we are still learning so much about COVID. We are in the earliest stages in that respect. Given that, can you point to a couple of ways in which the science, the scientific understanding of COVID and where the primary risks are, how that understanding as it grows is helping us kind of shift policies in terms of what really must be avoided versus other practices or activities that are not as risky as we might have feared they were, let's say, 3 months ago when we knew really next to nothing about COVID.
Yeah, I mean, I think people have definitely understood now it's contracted not just from touching another surface that somebody else who has COVID may have touched. It's also, you know, something you can get from the air, from respiratory interaction. So that means, you know, obviously being in close proximity to each other is that much more of a concern. I think in this country we really missed an opportunity to get ahead of this early on when there was, you know, more denial about how serious this was going to be coming out of Washington than we would have liked. I mean, we've certainly seen Western Europe and New Zealand and other parts of the world really conquer the spread of coronavirus in a way that we haven't been able to. And so part of it is, you know, we should have been testing so much earlier than we were. We should have been contact tracing so much more robustly than we were. And so there's still the opportunity to try to get a hold of those things, but it certainly would have minimized the amount of economic and health-related damage that we would have had we listened to the recommendations of the scientists and the doctors that have been working so hard to keep us safe. I think part of it's a fatigue, and I think part of it just culturally there's a bit of a reticence here on whether or not people want to believe that this is something that's real or not. And so if you're spending our time as a community trying to convince people whether or not there's really a problem, obviously mitigating the spread of coronavirus is so much harder. And so I guess that's the thing that, you know, in hindsight, I wish we could have gotten more people to take it seriously earlier. And then moving forward, the thing that I just know to be true, which isn't necessarily scientific, but it is certainly very human, this is hard on everybody. This is hard on people who get sick. It's hard on parents with kids. It's hard on small businesses. It's hard on workers who are scared about going to work and getting coronavirus from a customer or a coworker. So this is really hard on everybody. And I think your reminder, Greg, that we're in the early phases of this, probably in the second inning of a baseball game, if you want to think about it that way. So we've got a ways to go, and we're just going to have to learn a little bit more patience for one another and a little more kindness for one another in the midst of a really tough time with the coronavirus pandemic. And so that's, I guess, the one thing that I know to be true moving forward is that we've got to be empathetic to one another and think about not just what we're going through, but what others are going through as well.
I neglected to ask you one really important question about COVID, which is the fact that a number of parishes and congregations, certainly not all, but some have resumed in-person worship services, albeit with restrictions in place. At this point in time, looking at the numbers, do we have any reason to believe that the resumption of that activity has been any kind of factor in contributing to our COVID numbers? Or by and large, does it appear that these worship services are being conducted, at least for the most part, safely?
That's a great question. The Safer Racine Order does allow churches to go to 25% of their capacity to do that. You know, I wouldn't feel comfortable taking my family to church at this point. I mean, it's still very much something that you can catch from interacting with one another. And as much as we miss the fellowship in our own faith community and being able to, you know, have the kids enjoy Sunday school and get to have fellowship after the service with our friends, you know, at this point, it is far safer to continue to do worship services on Facebook or some other equivalent so that people don't get ill. Whether or not we can specifically link back any of the cases to a specific house of worship, I couldn't say. I'd have to look into that. But the best practice is still to maintain social distancing. And I know that is hard because we are human beings who naturally want to interact with one another, but that is really the safest thing we can do to keep everyone safe right now.
We're speaking with Corey Mason, the mayor of the city of Racine. Mayor Mason, of course, we need to speak for a couple of minutes about the protests and demonstrations in the city of Racine around Black Lives Matter and in the wake of the killing of George Floyd. And I'm curious, first of all, particularly on that dramatic night, I don't have the date in front of me, in which there was some violence that broke out in the city of Racine. I just wonder, what does the mayor of a city do in the midst of something like that? I guess I'm not really asking that personally. I'm asking that more professionally. I mean, what were your responsibilities as mayor during that particular period?
Yeah, I mean, there were two nights where things really flared up. One that was, you know, we had peaceful protesters who showed up, but unfortunately some of them were not peaceful. And after they dispersed the crowd at the police station, some of them, at least four of them, went to the Thelma Orr community-oriented police house and actually burned it down, committed arson in their frustration. And so obviously, like, I mean, that's enormously frustrating. You know, and we're constantly in communication with the chief of police and have sort of an ongoing understanding of what's going on when those moments happen. But the other thing that happened just a couple of days after that is, you know, we had another big protest that was peaceful, thankfully, not socially distanced, but it was at least peaceful. But at the same time, we had gang violence break out at North Beach and five people were shot. And so, you know, it is a reminder to all of us that we have a lot of work to do to take Black Lives Matter as a serious concept in this country, and certainly the Racine community is no different in the work that we need to do, which is why we've set up this police reform task force. But it was also a reminder that, you know, police play a very important function to keep us safe, and when, you know, when there's people getting shot at North Beach, there's a real role for police to play to keep us safe from that kind of violence. And so we will have a very hard dialogue ahead of us this year, but it's an important dialogue, and it's one that's long overdue, where we have to make sure that people have real trust and confidence in the police department, and I think that they do, but I think there's room for improvement, and I think the murder of George Floyd has seen, I think, us get to a tipping point in this country where people are demanding real reforms that they can see that are substantive and real, so that we don't continue to see the next story after George Floyd. It just seems like a litany of cases like this that happen a few times a year. We have to do better as a community and as a country, and I think that's where you're going to see a lot of focus this summer moving into the fall.
Not to name names, that's not what I'm asking for, but tell us, in general, who is comprising this task force and what they are specifically charged with doing, and are they already underway with their work?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we've certainly begun to do that work, and I announced some things that we do right away in terms of making police policies more transparent and available, and so we'll put that up on our website this week yet. But yeah, the task force is a mix of younger people and older people and African-Americans and Latino member communities and, you know, people, we have county officials and state officials that are serving on the task force. And they're really there to review the city of Racine's use of force policies, as many communities are doing around the country, and to review what citizen oversight looks like for our police department. So President Obama very wisely laid out a structure for communities like Racine to follow in terms of the sort of reforms we might want to look at. And so we're going to spend the next 90 days doing that earnestly. We've engaged Payne and Fraser, which is a local firm that has been doing some diversity training in some of our city departments to help facilitate this. So it'll be a task force that's charged with doing it, but it's going to be a very public-facing process where we're asking alders and our Affirmative Action and Human Rights Commission to assist the task force with meeting with the community as best we can with social distancing requirements so that we can hear from members of the public on the changes that they'd like to see and why they think this is so important to them.
Very good. Corey Mason, the mayor of the city of Racine. Mr. Mayor, we appreciate you taking the time to join us for this conversation. Very best wishes to you, and thank you again.
To you as well. Stay safe, everyone.
The time is 8:35, and you are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and here is part two. And we continue today's morning show by speaking with acclaimed broadcast journalist Soledad O'Brien about a documentary film that she has created that has been airing on Hearst television stations across the country, tonight airing on Milwaukee's WISN. And it's called Outbreak, The First Response. And it takes us back to the earliest days of the COVID-19 crisis in the United States, focusing on the battleground of Seattle, Washington, which was a very serious hotspot for COVID early on. Soledad O'Brien, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it.
So remind us, first of all, why Seattle? That is, why Seattle was such a trouble spot early in the COVID-19 crisis. Are we still sorting out, actually, what factors were at play in terms of making this such a serious hotspot?
For us, yes, the answer is we are still in many ways sorting that out. But for us, Seattle was first in the nation. And so we wanted to explore what happens to the city that is really the first in the nation that has to deal with this outbreak, the worst public health crisis in 100 years, with a public health department that is underfunded and understaffed, as most are, frankly, around the country. Public health, as you well know, has been, you know, funding has been cut over the last, you know, 20, 30 years under every administration, Democratic administrations, Republican administrations. And so how would they deal with this crisis as they were also first in the nation? We were shooting a doc, actually, on homelessness in Seattle when coronavirus broke out. And so we turned to our attention to what was happening in public health following embedding with the public health department and then seeing how they dealt with the most vulnerable populations, people in nursing homes, who we know had a huge death rate from coronavirus, not just in Seattle but around the country, and then homeless. The homeless population also very much at risk.
So in other words, this is not something where you were trying to go back and recreate what happened. You were in Seattle at the time. You were there with cameras and could capture what was unfolding, or at least many aspects of it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, we were there. And, our first meeting was sort of coronavirus has hit. We have crews out on the street. What do we do? I mean, it's obviously very risky to be shooting these stories. What do we do? And our photographers, who are phenomenal, decided, we really left it up to them. They're the ones who are kind of the front line. They decided they wanted to stay and capture this story and see how people were responding to this crisis.
Tell us who was most important for you in terms of being able to get behind the headlines and understand more profoundly what was going on. Who are the principal players who were also willing to be helpful to you in the making of this film?
Yeah, we interviewed a lot of people, and as most documentaries go, you shoot for hours and hours and hours, and then you take a small chunk of that and turn that into your project. We talked to a woman named Stevie who's living in her car with her daughter. She lost her job. She used to work at Amazon, lost her job, and was living in her car with her daughter. So imagine when the schools are shut down, as Seattle did, in order to help slow the spread of coronavirus. Well, if you're homeless and all of a sudden your school shifts to online schooling and you live in a car, The stress of that, we watch Stevie as she starts sort of thinking, well, what is coronavirus? I have all these other stressors. It's kind of the lowest on the list of things that are challenging for me to becoming hugely problematic for her. We follow the public health director, Patty Hayes, in Seattle, who's trying to figure out, as the first in the nation, what should their response be? Is shutting down schools too much? They understand, as most, you know, public schools also deal with feeding children, if they, you know, there are all these other unintended consequences if you shut down schools, and watching the pressure on Patty's staff. And then there's a woman whose dad is stuck in a nursing home. He doesn't have coronavirus, and she's desperately trying to get him out before he contracts it. But, of course, she's unable to do so, and she becomes his advocate, but sort of the advocate, you know, shouting through the window because she can't actually get into the building to see her dad. And, again, I think the most vulnerable populations dealing on the front lines with the virus.
Obviously, what we are talking about, for the most part, is a heroic story of people doing heroic things in trying to combat this terrifying virus, often under less than ideal circumstances. When it comes to that particular effort and capturing it, I'm especially interested to know how anxious you were that this be a heroic story mostly about what was done right, or if you were willing to also go to the matter of mistakes made and things not done as they perhaps should have been. Was that at all maybe a source of awkwardness for you in trying to decide how to tell this story?
That's such a great question, and no one's ever asked me that, and I've done probably 50 talks in my life. You know, you go in, I never go in thinking, like, this is a story of heroes, and I really don't go in thinking, like, this is a story of bad guys, and here's how we're going to frame it. I think you go in thinking, we're just going to watch it unfold and see. One thing you notice in public health is part of the ethos of public health is informing people. So when mistakes are made, they're almost sometimes unnervingly blunt about things that go wrong because, you know, in many cases, you're talking to epidemiologists who are looking at, why is there a spread over here? Here's what went horribly awry. So I don't know that any of the people involved would think that they're heroic. I think Stevie is a mess sometimes, and she'd be the first one to tell you that as she tries to figure it out. I think the woman who is advocating for her dad would tell you she's a pain in the ass, but she feels like she has to be, and she worries that by being a pain, is she actually hurting her dad's care because everyone's going to hate her, but she's trying to advocate for her dad basically, you know, over the phone and through a window. And I think Patty would be the last person to call herself heroic. I think she thinks of her teams as putting themselves in danger, but there's no other option. This is what they're supposed to be doing. So I don't think that they think they're heroic at all. And I don't even think the doc is framed like these are heroes. Often, I think, in coronavirus coverage, we think of the doctors and nurses as heroes. Public health experts would tell you, by the time you've arrived at that hospital needing a ventilator, public health has failed you, right? So the story is not those people who are the heroes helping people who are coming in and putting them on ventilators. It's how do we keep people from being safe, which is very sometimes unsexy and underfunded. They call them the invisible backbone, and, you know, public health is the invisible backbone. And I think when you're the invisible backbone, people don't think of you as a hero, and they also don't even think of you, which has its own problems. It means maybe you're not considered as important.
So in other words, one of the most important stories of this film is about those elements of this story that most of us do not see and do not understand in terms of how important they are in who is healthy and who is not and who is most vulnerable to succumbing to COVID-19.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's an interesting thing to see how many frustrated and angry homeless people we spoke to who said nobody really cared about us getting bathrooms until we could spread the disease. Nobody really cared about a washing station for us until we could become a liability for the greater population. And when this all ends, is that just go away? Because nobody really cares about us. It's just, are we vectors for disease? That's just a tough thing.
As COVID-19 has played out across the country, what have been your impressions of how other large metropolitan areas have handled COVID-19? Have lessons been learned from the story of Seattle?
I think by some places, sure. And I think we're seeing spikes in other places. places, Arizona, Florida, Texas, obviously. So I think in many, what's happened is mask wearing and even the virus itself and public health has been politicized, right? Like whether or not you wear a mask is a statement about your political leanings in some places. That's really not happened in public health before. And I think that becomes hugely problematic because it moves people away from the science of what we know about mask wearing and what we know about staying 6 feet apart and what we know about slathering yourself head to toe in hand sanitizer. And it moves into this idea of like, but I'm standing for something if I don't wear a mask, which most medical professionals and public health professionals will tell you is insane. So I think that's become hugely problematic. It wasn't really the issue in Seattle. Early on, people didn't think that they were making, you know, taking a stand in, you know, I say that in quotes in some capacity. Certainly where I am in New York, you can't get into a space. You can't go anywhere without wearing a mask. You can't, they won't let you in to a store. But in other places, I think, you know, not wearing a mask is celebrated, weirdly. So I think you're seeing some spikes, and that's, you know, that's going to continue this story of what the ultimate path and death toll around coronavirus is.
This documentary film, Outbreak, The First Response, A Look at COVID-19 in Seattle, Washington, airs tonight at 9 p.m. at Milwaukee's WISN-TV. And broadcast journalist Soledad O'Brien, I thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this powerful film. Best wishes to you as you go forward telling more important stories.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
It's 8:46, and you are listening to The Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. We finish out today's program with a morning show interview that was recorded and initially aired back in 2012. We will spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about a rather infamous moment in recent American history, that which occurred on the 16th of July, 2009, when renowned Harvard professor Henry Louis Gates, Jr., was handcuffed and arrested on the front porch of his own home by a Cambridge police sergeant. And all charges were later dropped, but in the minds of many, this was a clear indication of how far we, in fact, have not come as a nation when it comes to matters of racial equality. This is examined in a book called The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates, Jr., and Race, Class, and Crime in America. Its author is Charles Ogletree, who, to say the least, is well acquainted with this particular legal case since he served as counsel to Professor Gates in the aftermath of this incident. Mr. Ogletree is the Jesse Clemenko Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and the founder of the Charles Hamilton Houston Institute for Race and Justice at the Law School. This book is published by Palgrave. And Charles Ogletree, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Really happy to be with you this morning, Greg.
It's a very, very interesting book. I think many people are aware of at least the rough basic facts of what occurred to Professor Gates on the 16th of July, 2009. One of the things that your book does is to be as methodical as possible in laying out exactly what happened, exactly who did what, and ultimately what this story seems to be about is a leap to misunderstanding and assumptions made that simply cannot and should not be made by a police officer. Tell us what the sort of the kernel of the essential mistake that was made in this case.
Sure. Sergeant James Crowley was doing his job going to the scene of what he understood to be a burglary in progress at 17 Ware Street. So far, so good. When he arrived there, he didn't know Professor Gates, who lived there. And the first thing Professor Gates said, "I live here. This is my house." And Crowley wasn't convinced of that. Professor Gates gave him his Harvard ID, which showed that he was a Harvard University professor. And then he gave him his driver's license to show that he lived at 17 Ware Street. It didn't seem to satisfy the officer at all. And the real hero of this, Greg, is not Gates or Crowley. It's Miss Whalen, the woman who called police. And she said, I think they're pushing their way into a door. But she said this, I don't know if they live there or if they work there. She didn't say to criminals, I don't know if they live there or they work there. And I don't know how many people, Greg, in your experience, bring suitcases full of clothes to burglaries as opposed to taking them out of the house.
Right.
So she described two suitcases that they took into the house.
Hmm.
And so the reality is that it was a misunderstanding. And I say in the book, it's not just about race. It's about class. Hardworking, blue-collar police officer, and a prominent African-American professor. And it was a clash of class issues that who had control of the situation, who was being wronged, and who had the power to make an arrest.
Right. I think the point you just made about the ordinary citizen who initially made the call is an important one that's easily overlooked. The fact that she showed much more care and, in a sense, restraint, not jumping to conclusions, than the police officer did, and he's the one who's trained to think carefully and rationally in these kind of situations
and to de-escalate the situation. But she said something else. The dispatcher, we have this in the book, the 911 calls, all this is recorded. Ask, are these people black, Hispanic, or white? And she said one looks Hispanic. Right. She never said she saw two black men. She never said they had backpacks. But those things are in the police officer's report. Why? He says that the eyewitness told him that. She has said publicly and repeatedly, I never, ever mentioned African-Americans. I never mentioned backpacks. I don't know where that comes from. It certainly didn't come from me. So it tells you this chaotic situation that most people don't realize. It only took 6 minutes. It was 6 minutes from start to finish. Created a firestorm, not just in Cambridge, but around the country when the president interceded. And I think part of what we're saying now is that we have to move forward and figure out a better way to have good relationships between communities and police.
Give us your thoughts on President Obama's maybe somewhat impulsive comment on this incident very shortly after it occurred.
Well, I had the great honor of mentoring both Michelle Robinson Obama when she was at Harvard in 1985-88, and then President Barack Obama when he was there as a student 1988 to 1991. And I've worked on this campaign and still work with them in ways that I can. You may recall, Greg, people forget that this was when health care was the central issue, and he had a press conference about health care. The very last question was, do you have any comments on Professor Gates' arrest? The first two things he said should have been symbolic. Professor Gates is a friend of mine, and I don't know all the facts. Well, then maybe you don't want to get involved in this. But he did, and he got involved in two ways. The first thing he said was the Cambridge police acted stupidly. That's all we heard. But he went on to say, when they arrest a man in his own home, that blackened him, I say in the book, because a lot of whites thought that he'd taken a side as a black man of another black man against his working-class hard committed a white police officer. But he said something else. There is a problem of racial profiling in America, and African-Americans and Latinos have been involved in it. And as a member of the state Senate in Illinois, I supported legislation to deal with racial profiling. And blacks around the country said, we've never heard a president ever acknowledge we have a problem of racial profiling. So his intervention was helpful, and then it just blew up. And I think he responded by having the beer summit a week later, which calmed things down, but also made it worse in some senses because people continue to debate it. Glenn Beck, the conservative columnist, used it as a reason to then criticize the president as being racist toward whites, and everything was off the agenda. Healthcare didn't pass until December 2009, and so you can see how long that took to make that change. But the good news is that we've moved forward, and I think this is going to allow us to do some studies about issues of race and class and crime and not stick on what happened on July 16th, but what we need to do as a nation and as a people and moving forward.
One thing that you do in your book that I know has sparked at least a little bit of comment is that you suggest that actually rather little has changed in terms of race since the Rodney King beating back in 1991. I've seen in a couple of places people taking issue with the notion of drawing a parallel between that incident and this one. But clearly you believe that the details might be different, but in some respects at least, these are two faces of the same problem.
It's very interesting, Greg, and I hope people will read the book, because I think my view about Rodney King and Skip Gates has been, you know, unfortunately mischaracterized. What I said in the book is very clear. Rodney King was drunk. He was driving at excessive speed. He avoided police arrest by trying to get off the highway. And he committed a number of crimes that were clearly prosecutable, but they weren't. So I'm not saying that what happened to Rodney King being hit 57 times and struck in the head is the same as Professor Gates being arrested. I'm saying, what do we learn from that? And I wrote a book that you probably didn't read and probably most of America didn't read right after that as a result of the suggestion of Ben Hooks, then the president of NAACP, explain to us what happened with the Rodney King case, why there's such outrage among African-Americans, and what we can do. And my staff, the Criminal Justice Institute, we wrote a 300-page book with recommendations that we thought would be helpful. And when I see the Gates arrest and the fallout about it, you know, half taking the side of the police officer, half taking the side of the Gates, without people saying, how can we resolve it, then they didn't learn the lessons of Rodney King. So I'm not saying that Rodney King's beating is the same as Professor Gates' arrest. They're not. What I'm saying is that we should have learned as a nation that these things happen, and we have to find ways to address them. And I lay out the book, Ways to Address Them.
Sure.
So if people make the comparison, they miss the point. And I think that's what happens. You take a sentence out of a book rather than looking at the hundreds of pages and get a full sense that I say we all have to learn. People shouldn't do what Gates did, demand the CID. There's other ways to respond to police misconduct. People should not think the police are not doing their job. They are. They don't often have tools to deal with that. And people should not make assumptions based on race, because police officers are black, brown, white, women, and men who work very hard in our communities and do a good job. It's those who step outside the mainstream that create the problems, and that's what we should focus on.
At one point in your chapter where you talk about the King incident, you say, in hindsight, it is worth asking the plaintive question raised by Rodney King in a public plea to end the riots, which, of course, ensued, when he asked, can we all get along? That question is regrettably still worthy of answer nearly
two decades later. That's my point. You know, we're still asking, can we all get along? And my hopeful prayer is that, yes, we can, because we should learn from this, and no one should be subjected to unlawful police activity. And yet, police should not be prohibited from doing what they have to do to enforce the law. There is a middle ground, and it's not that hard to find if we work real hard to make it happen.
Absolutely. The book, again, is called The Presumption of Guilt, The Arrest of Henry Louis Gates Jr., and Race, Class, and Crime in America. It's published by Palgrave Macmillan and the author Charles J. Ogletree Jr. Mr. Ogletree, I thank you so much for writing this very thoughtful book and for joining me today on the Morning Show.
Thank you for having me on. Very much appreciate it.
Once again, that interview with Charles Ogletree was recorded back in 2012. Tomorrow on the Morning Show, we're going to be finding out about four performances that are being given this coming weekend of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing, delivered virtually by the Fleeing Artists Theater Company based in Kenosha. It's two different casts, actually, one locally based, and the other cast features actors from far-flung places like Oregon and Vancouver, Canada. Over 200 actors anxious for an opportunity to act auditioned also virtually to be part of this production. And tomorrow we'll hear from director Alex Matowski and from three of the actors who are involved in this weekend's performances. Also tomorrow on the program, Stephen Ribello's recent book called Dolls, 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 a look back at the famous novel and infamous movie version of it called Valley of the Dolls. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Their doors may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. You can visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. We're approaching 9 o'clock.